summer night, would you offer your throat to the wolf of the red roses?
Will he honor me in his mouth?
Yes.
Will he honor me in his teeth?
Yes.
Will he honor me in his jaws?
Yes.
Will he honor me in his hunger?
Yes.
Again, will he offer me his hunger?
Yes.
And will he starve without me?
Yes.
Again, this sweet radio fade.
Okay, the only thing he won't offer her is free software, which is what he should be offering her. Okay? That's our first musical add-in. Next week we'll do a little bit better than that. I want to welcome everybody to the NYLX second, actually, radio broadcast. Tonight we have a room full of very esteemed members of NYLXS and even one pseudo-member by the name of Billy Donahue. And we hopefully have for you a very exciting show about what's happening in the New York City Linux movement and the GNU Linux movement and the free software movement, both technical and political. And stay tuned for a good show. Right now, let me introduce the people that are here. First of all, there is our main technical guru here, who is our sound expert, Marcos, or Marco. Say hello, Marco.
Hello, everyone.
And we have, of course, our public relations expert here, Joe Gastera.
Hello.
Say hello to Chris.
Hi, Christina.
Okay, and of course, we have our resident guru here, Billy Donahue.
Good to be here, Ruben. Thanks.
There you go. Okay. And I'll tell you who's not here. Who's not here is Rick Stallman, but we'll get him next time. In any event, let's go through a few of the things that we hope to accomplish with this radio broadcast. And the first thing I want to say is that over the next few weeks, we will hopefully have call-in. That's the next thing that also has to happen next week. And in addition to call-in, we'll be able to handle your, obviously, your calls, and we'll be able to make this a two-way conversation. Meanwhile, if you want to join us, you can join us at on IRC at irc.linux.com/NYLXS.com, the Excessive Neurotic Linux Users Group of New York. And for our agenda tonight, for the things that we want to discuss, first of all, we'd like to discuss a little bit of the technology that we're using here to broadcast tonight. And then we want to discuss some of the impending legislation that's happening in Washington, D.C., and the political issues that are that we're going to be facing in the next couple of weeks, including the new fair use bill that we hope to get on the boards in the next coming months. And we also hope to discuss a little bit about desktop support and using free software on the desktop and how we could work at getting things into business so that we can get more people actually working with free software, especially in these recessionary period where a lot of free software people have been unemployed or relegated to working with proprietary software. So we would like to see more people working with free software in their businesses, and we'd like to also try to make a move, especially now with new licensing issues coming up with Microsoft XP, to try to get GNU systems and free software systems onto the mainstream business desktop, which is where it needs to be. Okay, so first, for opening segment, let's first discuss some of this technology. Marco, what are we running here?
We are running an Icecast server, and I'm seeing we're getting a couple more connections since our announcements on the other chat lists. And the Icecast is just, you have to think of Icecast as just a traffic cop, actually, for sound streams. So instead of sending the sound to your speakers, you send it to Icecast, and then other people can come and connect into Icecast and receive the sound in their sound player. And it's all free software. We're broadcasting an MP3 stream tonight. Eventually, we'll be switching over on an Ogg Vorbis stream, which will be a completely free codec as well.
What's the advantages of using Ogg Vorbis instead of using MP3s?
Some of the algorithms to compress MP3s are not licensed or patented by individuals, which make it not a completely free codec.
So you're saying that basically MP3s are not free software?
Not free codec.
Translate?
Not free coder. The decoders.
The decoders. In other words,
anybody can make a decoder. I don't think that's patented. The encryption, encoding is.
The encoding is.
The encoder.
So it's really like a critical matter for free software to have a coder that's free. Otherwise, it's going to be blocked by whatever spyware systems want to come up.
You'll always be at the mercy of the Fraunhofer Institute as long as you're coding MP3s, sure.
And even if it's a different codec, same problem. If it's proprietarily owned, the bottom line.
Well, right.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, real audio, for example, I mean, that's a whole, you can't get anything out of those guys. you can't implement the free real audio.
There's a huge problem with codecs as well as software. I mean, getting your media out there in a free form is a definite problem that has to be addressed as well. And Ogg Vorbis is a first and wonderful step in that direction. It compresses down better than MP3s at this moment.
Okay, now, we have somebody's asking us online why isn't LAME free software, which is one of the encoders, right?
LAME is the... We are using LAME to do the encoding tonight. And I believe it's just that the Fraunhofer is willing to give the... to give
the specification's open,
though. Huh?
Is the specification open, yes or no?
I believe so.
We can look this up.
The specification is open, ultimately, but that's not what patents are all about, is it? An implementation isn't patented. An implementation would be a copyright issue. This is a patent issue, which means that the very idea behind compressing the MP3 would be something that the Fraunhofer Institute can restrict.
And we've actually had this problem, actually, with the encoders that are using for ripping, right?
So whether or not they give away a free implementation... whether or not they give away an implementation of an MP3 coder, they're still not giving away the whole store, because you can't make another MP3 coder without their permission.
Got it. And that's actually been an issue for certain encoders, right? What's the name of that encoder that I used to rip with called something with a B?
I forget.
Ben Ancock or something like that. The best encoder that I had seen, something with a B, I forgot what it is, but I know that the guy stopped development in that because he was getting legally harassed.
Was it Broadcast 2000?
No, it wasn't Broadcast 2000.
Broadcast 2000 is a whole other mess.
That's a whole other mess, yes. We were trying not to get involved with that today.
We'd be set on all sides.
Yeah. So I asked, of course, the people who are yelling at us about LAME and giving us URLs, what is free? You know, free means that the software itself can be used. We can just click on that. Free just means that the software itself can be coded freely and worked on freely. And one of the problems that we had, of course, getting this radio show together is that the damn encoder is not free, and LAME is truly LAME. So we're working on it. Of course, if we go to Ogg Vorbis, which is what we intend to do in a week or so, then it will be that much easier for us to handle things, because we will actually be handling something that's actually free.
Yeah, that link was just the LAME page. We were on it as well. Thanks, Sunny.
Okay. Now I have a question about this type of broadcast. Is it possible to do this with a smaller machine?
Yeah.
How much horsepower do we need in order to do something like this?
It depends on the number of connections coming in, actually. But the MP3 encoding needs a Pentium 200 about to be comfortable, because it is slightly CPU intensive. But this machine is probably overkill. Certainly overkill.
You think this machine is overkill?
Well, what is this machine?
It's a
1.5 gigabytes megahertz Pentium 4 system.
Gigabytes and megahertz.
Gigahertz, whatever. It's huge.
the connection's the most important.
With our listeners, it's huge. You got that? It's a 21 gigabyte megawatt.
Here's the problem. We couldn't find a reasonable size CPU anymore. They only make them like 20,000 more times powerful than you need. But the thing is that encoding, though, is relatively CPU intensive anyway, so I think that it would be advantageous in this particular case to have a decent or to have the better CPU.
I imagine we're just encoding once, actually, so encoding one MP3 stream is not...
I hope so.
I mean, it would be ridiculous. I think we're just encoding once, because I'm piping the encoded sound into the streamer, and then Icecast is actually doing the rebroadcasting, so that's definitely, we're only encoding once.
Okay, that's cool. Now, for anybody's information, we will be storing these systems on the hard drive, and they will be every week we will be making them available after the broadcast for your download at your leisure.
Except for this one, which is too embarrassing.
No.
We'll erase this one in a couple of weeks.
Now, I'd just like to also talk about the radio format itself. The radio format, very much like NYOXS itself, is going to be somewhat of an informal presentation. We seem to do best when we are somewhat informal. And in addition to that, I like to keep things so that we can have give and take. I would be very happy if a fistfight broke out on the radio show. That would be fine. Barring that, we should get into, we should have be able to get into some decent conversations, and we hope to have.
And when we have the call in, that'll certainly.
That'll help, certainly, yes. Then
and we'll be able to pipe other sounds rather than just us talking. We'll have music and the call in all going out
right.
to the street.
I
assume we'll be trying to get guests in as well.
Definitely.
Yes, that's your job as PR guy.
Right.
Yeah. Also, I'd like to say something actually about NYLXS in its own right, especially since this has come up recently not like off the hook, but since this has come up, I had a very humorous email over the weekend, which I found quite funny, which says essentially that NYOXS could simply have been any other organization. We could be promoting Mac OS or Windows, or for that matter, horse racing. And yes, whoever sent that email, we don't know who that is exactly, but whoever sent that email, that is exactly what NYOX is supposed to be. It's supposed to be doing the things that really are translatable to any other environment, and the things that are not currently really being done well in the free software movement currently. And these are the very basic business type of things that need to be done. Time after time, people come over after we give one of our rousing in-services or discussions or after the demo, and people come up and they say, you know, I'm very excited by what you guys are saying. How can I help you? Maybe I can rewrite your website or hack your kernel or teach a programming class. And teaching is somewhat important. But what we really need is what every other organization needs. We need a secretary. We need people who hand out flyers. We need people who know how to write their congressmen. We need people that can organize a schedule and keep us on schedule. We need people who call people up and say, we're having this event happening on Thursday or Friday, and we'd like you to come down and help. We even need people to do some silly things like moving tables, folding chairs, writing checks, keeping track of accounts and accounting, and to help us promote free software in government and in business, and to try to help people find jobs, which is really something that we've been trying to, I've been trying to particularly cover, to get somebody to, help find other people jobs. And this is just very routine work, and it's tedious, but it's the kind of stuff that has to be done. We wanted to get into the high schools, right? How are we going to get into the high schools? I need somebody to call up Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Well, they can skip Friday maybe. and call up high schools, walk in the door with a tie on preferably, or a mini skirt if that's your gender or your preference, and make the sale. Look, we are teaching free software to high school or junior high school kids, and we would like to be able to show you what we can do. And can you help us do this kind of thing? And this is flat-out sales work. And this is not heavy hacking. There's enough heavy hackers out there, and they're doing a very good job. We hope to also interface with developers so that they can develop in a way that we could help businesses using free software better. We have made the claim over the years that free software is better because it allows the business to customize the software for their needs, in that the business can take complete ownership. But what we haven't had is a liaison between the developers and the businesses in order to be able to get
feedback.
In order to be able to get that intermediate step where we have a situation where we have people going to businesses and they go, let's say they go to lawyers, and the lawyers say, well, we need something that can do this. It can be something very simple. Lawyers depend very heavily on word processing templates, and so then we need somebody not to hack a kernel, but to deal with OpenOffice, and to be able to hack OpenOffice's built-in tools designed for secretaries to handle and create the necessary pre-installed templates so that we can go over and we can get free software and lawyers, because without that, you can have the best Beowulf clusters in the world and it's just not going to mean a damn thing. So it's a matter of if you're going to have a hobby horse operating system or if you're going to have something that really works for business. If you're going to have something that really works for business, we need to have that liaison situation also. Now that I've talked for 20 minutes without interruption, I'll
we're
let
somebody
else
comment. We're not dropping too many clients. That's what I'm most impressed about, Ruben. As you can see,
there you go.
We had a good solid 10 minutes and no clients dropped.
Wow.
But we have on Thursday, we have the open house for the FSI Institute. That would be good to
okay,
mention.
First, before we move on to that, any comments on that? What was said?
I think you just brought up the point is that there hasn't been any feedback mechanism between the people actually doing the kernel hacking and the people who actually need to use the end product. You know, so when you have the situation when it's sort of tech guys making stuff for tech guys, you can't expect any adoption in the non-tech world or by, you know, sort of non-power users. So it's important to relay the needs of non-tech users back to the guys actually doing the coding so we can see some of these features implemented. And we can see adoption of free software, and we can free our schools and our government from this sort of proprietary software enslavement.
Yeah. I'd like to add to that that also from a business perspective, the current businesses that have survived the latest recession, there has been a general problem that the same problem that VA had when VA went for the big guns. You know, they want to target large businesses doing customized software stuff like chaos theory calculations and so on for Swiss Bank or whatever, weather satellite stuff. You saw IBM just got a sale of selling their mainframe servers to do weather predictions. But what we really need to do is fill a gap that is currently completely devoid, which is the gap right now of who's selling GNU products or GNU Linux products to the desktop user, which is where it has to be. Now the question comes, why
does
that
have
to be?
Yeah.
There you go. Any thoughts on why it's got to be?
Well, why does it have to be?
Well,
this
gets back to the famous Jay Sulzberger analysis, which is completely correct, but sometimes takes a little while to understand.
Okay.
Jay Sulzberger will tell you that there is no such thing as competition above the level of the operating system. And the reason for that...
Okay. We can have this discussion once we settle on a definition of an operating system, which everyone seems to be unclear about.
Right. This is another discussion. But the bottom line of Jay's feeling is this, and in giving it proper thought, you realize he's right. And this has actually happened and played out previously in business. If you're, let's say, making a product on a Microsoft Windows platform, or one of the Microsoft dozens of Windows platforms that are currently available, then if you're going to make, let's say, a competing... If you're going to make a competing, it's good to curse on the radio. But
hey, no FCC, we could say fucking shit.
If you're going to compete on against, let's say, Office, right, and you're going to make a word processor, right? Well, Microsoft understands the operating system, and if you become any kind of threat to Microsoft, they're going to tweak their operating system so that your system doesn't work as well as theirs. Now, it's not theoretical that this might happen. This is exactly what happened to Borland and Microsoft. Borland was making Turbo Pascal and developing good C programs and visual programs in Delphi, and they were completely taken out by Microsoft, essentially by Microsoft creating products that would make use of secretive DLLs or system calls, and on top of that, they went over and made sure that the other people's stuff didn't work. And the same thing happened in Netscape. Netscape's browser became increasingly buggy on Windows as Internet Explorer continued to develop. And then idiots would come to me and say, well, Internet Explorer, you know, Netscape's no good, it's not as good as Internet Explorer. It so happened that when the Mozilla people did get away, finally did wedge the Netscape code that, in fact, it probably wasn't that good. I doubt that the Internet Explorer code is any better. But the bottom line was is that Microsoft was undermining the browser via the system calls. So this is IBM is making this big play for servers, right? And here's the problem. IBM is making a big play on servers based a lot of it being based on Samba and other Microsoft desktop networking. Microsoft can change that tomorrow. And they can just decide that they're not even going to load Samba anymore on there, and they're going to come up with something completely different that's incompatible, and they're not even going to give out a spec. And that blows away IBM's mainframes right out of the server market. The control point, the chokehold point for all systems is the operating system on the desktop. So that's the argument.
Is it the operating system on the desktop that's really the choke point, or is it the applications on the desktop?
Well, if you go...
I guess it's both. I mean, it's one and the same. It's it's back to your definition of an operating system.
Right, but like I said, if you go over and you create a competitive application, you think that you have an application competition that you can have with Microsoft, you can't. You can't. I mean, you can, but you will fail. In the long run, you will fail. Because they will tweak the operating system if you become any threat so that your product won't work right anymore.
Because they'll just buy your company.
Why are we pushing competing products then?
It's off the shelf. It's off the shelf. It's like what the pharmaceutical companies allow competing products also. Now they do it just to keep themselves out of antitrust activity. But the truth of the matter is that Microsoft doesn't have to come out and say anything. They do it over time. Over 6 months, a year, 2 years. Before you know it, their product's not working anymore. And there you go. Real player and XP. That's another example, right? The real player, I hear the complaint all the time from people, why doesn't my real player work anymore? Well, the reason why it doesn't work anymore is because the XP operating system is designed to destroy it. In fact, it's a targeted market. And the same thing with AOL. That's what AOL is so worried about also. They're worried about basically their interface being no longer compatible with Windows. So they're full control. As long as they control the operating system on the desktop, that's the choke point. Politically, business-wise, educationally, that's the choke point. If basically this is the eyes, what you see in front of you, the keyboard, the machine, and the screen, and the mouse are your eyes and ears, the universe. Whoever can control that choke point controls everything. And you can come up with as many applications as you want, and if Microsoft decides that they don't want it, or they want to go in competition against it, they will destroy it. I'm actually surprised they've never seriously taken on Adobe yet. But don't ask me why that's the case. I guess they're too busy fighting the federal government right now.
Well, you sound like you've already thrown in the towel, Ruben, if you say that they will destroy it.
No, the alternative, of course, is to get off the Microsoft operating system. The question, what brings this up in the first place is why do businesses need to get on a free open source desktop? And even more importantly, the real question is why is the desktop so damn important to free software developers and free software people? And the reason for this is because it's the chokehold point. And it's just amazing how many people don't get it. I have 15 PhDs doing Linux kernel hacking, and I am a genius in computers. Bullshit. All right? If you don't understand that you need to be able to have you need to have a working operating system on the desktop that can handle business needs, and that you have to get that stupid dumb stuff out of the way, like templates for lawyers and network connectivity on the desktop that's smooth and having other applications there, then you have no prayer. In addition to that, you're being put in a position where ultimately you're going to be eliminated. You will be, or at minimum, you're going to be migrated, which is currently what's happening actually, migrated to a very small segment of the computing market, which is just specialized applications that deal with big iron, which is increasingly less and less.
Big iron?
Mainframes.
Oh. Sorry.
How do you get the Carnegie Hall?
Huh?
How do you get the Carnegie Hall?
Say practice.
Practice, practice, practice. Marcos in France, in Germany, in Washington, which is even a stranger place. Okay, anyway.
I'm convinced they're all hired actors that no one actually lives in Washington.
So anyway, this is the reason why we have really been trying to emphasize getting desktops out there and pushing for it hard, and we will continue pushing for it hard. In fact, I'm even a little annoyed when we go so far out of the way to try to imitate the Microsoft desktop functionality, because we'll never win this game. They keep coming up with functionality, we keep copying it. They come up with more functionality, we keep copying it. Then half the world complains on mailing lists all across the nation, if not the world, well, you know, your desktop is really not mature because your genome cache doesn't do XYZ that QuickBooks does. Well, of course not, you know, because QuickBooks is the originator. And so instead, we really need to focus on being original. One of the reasons why the GIMP is such a powerful application is because it's not Photoshop anymore. It's far different from Photoshop and very powerful. In its own way, far more powerful than Photoshop. And when people come over and say, well, it's not as powerful as Photoshop because it doesn't have this right-click thing with a circle, banana thing? Well, the answer should be, yeah, no kidding, you know, because it's not Photoshop. Yes, it's not Photoshop. It's got XYZ features that are far more powerful than what's in Photoshop and things that we should be looking at doing.
I mean, this is also the point about how the new Photoshop allows scripting with JavaScript. And basically they're just trying a lame attempt to catch up with the GIMP's many, many options for scripting it. Right, you can use Perl and...
It's amazing how big
our
JavaScript
is. The entire GIMP is completely scriptable with Perl, and JavaScript is only what Adobe decides they will, you know, provide to their customers will be scriptable, but it's a complete sandboxed land, like I said in the long email today.
Right. What does that mean by sandbox, though? Explain that.
Huh?
What do you mean by sandbox? Explain that.
Well, the sandbox means that if you're using the proprietary application or the proprietary system, and every single piece of everything you're allowed to do has been decided by the marketing department of that application, there's no ifs, ands, or buts around it. Right? If Adobe
which
decides...
Which is not a commendation of language, I think, which is a poor language.
Huh?
Own right.
Well, no, I was separating the argument about JavaScript and whatever its weaknesses might be from the fact,
like the fact that,
that
it has no external libraries.
You can't extend it.
You can't extend it. Inheritance is shot.
If Adobe didn't think it was a good idea, it's not in there, and you're stuck if you want to do something.
You can extend JavaScript with Java.
No, but you can extend
it
as much as you want. Whatever the point is, you're only dealing with whatever API that Adobe has decided to give.
That's right. You only have
the however much liberty Adobe has decided to put out there without giving full access to its code base. In the GIMP, you can go in and get any single object in the entire code base of a thing
and
rebuild the application with the Perl plugin if you want. Right? I mean, that's a complete power over the application, which you'll never have when you're trying to script an application with the... with the proprietary guys.
You know, it's... I don't think Adobe is not aware of the increasing encroachment by a product like GIMP, as well as a number now of vector-based graphic programs that are also out there, which are slowly improving onto their domain. And they're very concerned about this, even though they would never admit it. But, you know, as strongly as the graphic artists that are out there have been trained and in what's I'm trying to use a word that's not insulting like brainwashed, but trained and
no, you can't get training in any other software except the Macromedia and the Adobe. I mean,
yeah,
it's true. If you go to art school, you are taught Macromedia and Adobe.
And of course,
you come out with 4 years of
This is in itself it's a major problem, right? Because basically, what is the graphic? You go into an art school, and what are you supposed to be learning? You're supposed to be learning art, the principle of color, design, and form.
But you learn Photoshop 6.0, and when you graduate there, it's
and the layers and masks and how digital computers work with graphics. These are scientific or art ideas, not how to left click with mouse.
The shortcut used for Photoshop.
Right, which is amazing. You know, it's very exciting actually though to sit there and look at a real photo experienced graphic artist sit there and crash a Macintosh using Photoshop because they have it down. So, and here's the problem essentially. There's no sense arguing with them about it, which is why I was so vindictive a little bit about that discussion, because there's no arguing with them about it. These guys are capable of crashing Macs, which is a fairly stable OS, right?
But, Ruben, there's no art without the resistance of the medium.
There you go.
We're going to all think about what that means for a minute.
is it the absolute resistance of the medium, or is it the resistance of the marketing department of the proprietary medium which you happen to be using? And that's the huge problem.
If you're going to accept digital computer-aided art
there
as a legitimate art form, you have to put the ability to crash the computer in there, into the program.
Oh,
Photoshop itself must crash, or the art will suck and not be legitimate.
There you go. Okay.
But you must be in the control of the crashing, right?
Well, here's... okay. Billy's
so people will never be able to do digital art on Linux?
I'm sorry.
Can I get
some more scotch? Where's the scotch?
By the time you're doing interesting art on Linux, you'll be crashing the thing, too.
I don't know. I've never seen a GIMP, even when it's quote-unquote unstable crash Linux. I've seen it freeze X occasionally. Anyway, but what I want to say is that these people are so capable of handling Photoshop in their sleep that they are screens ahead, right? They're pressing the stack. They're clicking here. They're not even looking at the graphic anymore that they're working on. Mm-hmm. There are 8-9 screens. Meanwhile, the Mac OS is sitting there going through all the rendering screens, 20 seconds behind what they're doing, and then all of a sudden the whole thing just freezes and breaks, right, and crashes. But the point here is that they're so trained in Photoshop that they have this level of capability. So if they're going to get on the GIMP, they're just not going to have that level of indoctrination. And this is a huge problem to try to overcome. But the first thing that has to be overcome is a discussion of the issue, especially when you're talking to graphic artists, which is that, look, we know that you're using this product, but you know it like the back of your hand. You know, this is like learning another language. Once you speak English, to speak German is very not easy for certain people, and vice versa. And there is that issue that's into account. But
that's an issue of legitimacy, too. Sometimes people feel that something with a corporate stamp, you know, will function better. You know, so it's a matter of also demonstrating that the program is every bit as powerful and flexible, and that they'll be able to do it.
And remember that you need users and you need people producing work with the GIMP, and that's another thing to sort of advertise and broadcast, and you know.
Well, something which catches me on the Photoshop / you know, Photoshop and versus GIMP decision is, how can I jump off of Photoshop onto the GIMP unless I'm absolutely sure that someone will be working on the GIMP, that it won't become one of these two-pass, three-pass software versions which then gets abandoned.
The GIMP is really well evolved. I don't know if
it
you
is.
Use it at all. I mean, it really is. I don't have much doubt that the GIMP is going to hang around. But obviously, you have. I mean, there are free software products where you wonder, is this thing going to last anymore?
Yeah, I think GIMP's on the level of something like Apache now, where clearly it's, you know, it's just not going anywhere.
In the free software world, I do think that the GIMP is to be. I mean, stable enough that you could imagine it's going to hang around, and you can invest the time to work in it and learn how to use the program.
But, you know, we should be sort of recruiting and coaxing real artists that do, you know, sort of real work with digital art to be producing in the GIMP and to be showing their colleagues that they can do the same.
Well, one of the ways...
Artists love to save money.
Well, that's true, yeah. Artists
well, all artists have stolen cracked versions of Photoshop anyways.
That's
not
right.
I mean, that's not the point, you know? And Adobe knows that they have hundreds and millions of people that have cracked versions, and they're leaving them in this sort of semi-illegal state as part of the marketing plan.
Wait, it's not a semi-legal state.
Well, you're in a completely
it's
illegal
state. It's a completely
state,
illegal
but
state, yes.
Were Adobe to decide that they were not going to have Photoshop is absolutely impossible to copy to different machines or whatever, they could put a sort of... I mean, it could make it impossible for
well,
you
they
to
did
have...
Well, they did that at
They
one
would
point.
Make it impossible for you to have a cracked copy.
They did that at one point, and what the result was is outrage and then drop in the...
Yeah, with exactly. So they
of course, they had real competition at that point. They had CorelDRAW and other... products that
well, they tried again recently with Photoshop 6 to have this sort of networking thing where if two version numbers of Photoshop on the net at the same time, one would kill the other one.
I would like to go back, just a half step there, and talk about the issue of corporate branding of something. Some of the recent writing that I've done has discussed this issue, and really we need to start turning that backwards onto... We want to start turning that backwards onto itself, right?
Go. Talk.
What we want to do is turn that backwards onto itself. What does that mean? What we want is a circumstance where when we go over and we talk to people about their products, right, we want to, before they even get a word out of their mouth, that I need something corporate, right, or I need something that's by blah, blah, blah. We need to cut that off before they even get it out of their mouths. We know what the argument is before going in, so why do we wait? We should be saying right away, why would you want to use a product that is only supported by a few little programmers, you know, in some corporate company that's looking really to squeeze every cent that they can from you, right? When instead you can be using a product that is supported by NYLXS's entire group, and in addition to that, as an extension to that,
how many programmers just want to work on it?
In addition to that, we have a whole they are just a front for a larger free software technical group, which gives unparalleled levels of tech support and has the ability to do feature changes and bug fixes on the fly. And so why would you want to, who are you going to trust? You're going to trust some little company like Adobe, you know, with your lifeblood of your company for tech support, or Apple, you know, who has done tech support numerous times, or are you going to trust the cadre of the best programming minds, or computer science minds, that are available today in any organization in the world. Now, obviously, you have to trust the free software people. And that, so we need to really get in there right away and turn that argument around.
Because there's an accountability issue in passing the buck if something goes wrong.
That's right. Who's going to be accountable? Microsoft's going to be accountable? No.
Has there ever been a case of a software company?
And that's another thing, too. You've got to tell them, are you going to be liable when Adobe goes over and puts your entire shop out of business, you know, for an hour? Or you know, this becomes more of an issue like with mailing clients, right? Who's going to be liable when your corporation's down like it was just this past week, right, with the Klez virus, right, for 6 hours when you have 500 people making, you know, $65 million in salary sitting on their hands because of a virus? Who's going to be responsible for that? You wouldn't want it, certainly I wouldn't want that responsibility, for sure. I would want to make sure that I have a product, that I have a reliable source of technical help and has a proven track record of being secure and effective. And that's just not going to be the Microsoft product, because when you open up that license, it says right there they have no warranties. It's as clear as daylight. They say they're not responsible.
I think, I mean, it could actually be an open source of interest to actually read the software licenses of the proprietary products to people. Have you read? I mean, you have to click through it, right? You click, you read.
You don't got to read it. You don't got to read it. You just have to take selected.
It highlights the selected sentences, important sentences.
Just have to take
and you read the own license. And there's nothing
sentences.
Clear.
But you also have to be not afraid to use FUD. And it's not even FUD, because it's real. You know, when you're taking a $60 million hit for 24 hours because your mail servers are down and your corporation can't talk to themselves anymore and your servers are no longer functioning and they're out of work, that's not FUD.
What's FUD mean?
Oh, I've forgotten already. Yes, sense of fear. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's not FUD. It's no longer FUD. And you got to tell them, who's going, when your boss comes into you and asks you what's the problem, what are you going to do? You know?
Yeah, shrug. I don't know.
What are you going to do?
I'm waiting for the response
you.
From
Are you prepared? Are you prepared to have your ass canned, you know, because you decided that you were going to use the Exchange server and cost your company, especially the small company, right, or a medium-sized company, cost your company, you know, like a third of a quarter's profits?
Well, you know, I think the problem is, too, that, you know, people have been convinced by Microsoft that, hey, computers just crash. It happens a few times a day. Don't worry about it. You know, you'll lose some data. Don't worry about it. That's just computers.
Well, they get conditioned. The computers are complex.
Hey, sometimes the mail's down a couple times a month. What are you going to do?
And mail's a very complicated system because we've been using mail since the early 60s and we still don't have it right, obviously. Don't give me that look.
It's just surprising me that people tolerate this, you know, considering that email these days has to be far more important than even phones as a mechanism for communication.
Oh, that's before we get discussion of encryption. Like, there's no cryptography on a basic desktop, no matter what they are, but when you do install SUSE, it gives you actually an option when you install it. Do you want to have encrypted hard drives? So here's the situation. You have a company, and they're really hot. They make everybody mobile, right? So they give them 1,000 laptops. They have them all sign these non-disclosure agreements that if you sneeze about our company, you'll fire you, sue you, and take your firstborn, right? And then they go over and they give them these laptops, and what happens? They lose them on the train. The security staff steals them out of their office. Right? They just disappear. And every corporation has this problem where they just disappear.
Hell, MI5 has this problem.
There you go. And they disappear. Meanwhile, when they disappear, you have this operating system that's got no security. And a hard drive, you talk about industrial, you know, espionage, right? You have a hard drive that's completely unencrypted. They can just take the hard drive out and mount it to another system and read it. All the data. I mean, you are completely exposed. And who's going to be responsible for that? Do you want to be the person that's supposed to be responsible for that? If you're conducting your business, is this what you want to have potentially happen to you? How would you feel, Mr. Government Official, if your political adversary got a hold of your stuff because somebody accidentally lost their laptop? That would suck big time, right? Okay. Did we cover that?
We covered it.
Okay.
You guys got that?
Got it?
Everyone understand?
So, with SUSE Linux distribution, there's an option to encrypt the whole hard drive when you install it.
That's right.
It makes the whole system slower, obviously.
Yeah, sure, but sometimes that's acceptable, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. So what do? You have a password when you boot up and you're logged in? And
I've got no idea. I've never used it. But you know what? We should maybe demonstrate that and see what it does. But I think, yes, I think there's probably something having this. My guess is it hooks into your PAM authentication with the MD5.
PAM? Well, PAM would already be on the hard drive at that point. I mean, PAM would already be part of the encrypted data.
Yeah, but the binary could come up.
Maybe your home screen. Maybe your home partition is the only the only encrypted part. When you log in,
yeah, you would
encrypt your own
encrypt certain partitions.
No, the only thing that's not encrypted is the boot partition.
Oh, the whole thing's encrypted.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes, I guess.
We'll give it a whirl. I have no idea how the decryption functions at all.
I got no idea. I do know that it's not.
But could it be? Is it like a thing you pass to the kernel and then? If the kernel's not encrypted, right?
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out. We can't make up. What was the? Our
we should have
we'll
an in-service.
Get back to
an in-service on this.
Right.
Okay.
Get a laptop. Have Susie 8. Try to get the encryption.
Well, we do that. You know, we had the Linux One class, and this is a good segue into our Free Software Institute thing. But we do have that class where we actually do install SUSE, and maybe we should take a shot at it and see what happens with it. You know, see if any of our newbies have any luck with that. Which brings us to the next thing.
Upcoming events?
Upcoming events. Well, let's first talk about our role in trying to bring more education to individuals. If you're in New York City and you hear this, and if you have an IT department, or you are a student or an individual that wants to learn more about free software, and you want to learn it in a systematic and rational way, not just by banging around on your keyboard and running around from half of this manual to half of that manual, like most people do. We have a very inexpensive and effective teaching program to give people a head start on free software, particularly GNU Linux. We have an Introduction Linux 1 and a Linux 2 class where you basically start out with your own empty computer, and you learn how to install the operating system, not just one distribution, but a couple of distributions. And you get the chance to do it a couple of times as we systematically go through the ins and outs of what an operating system is, which is what Billy was asking before, and how file systems are laid out, and how package management works, and how your basic networking is configured, and so on. And one of the reasons why we do this through a couple of distributions, at least, is so that people have an understanding that despite whatever GUI they're using, that basically the same fundamental principles are being worked out through all of the distributions. Now, one of the things I'll segue and say here is that it's completely untrue that GNU Linux and its various distributions is hard to install. It really is so easy to install at this point. I saw somebody do this the other day in 25 minutes on an IBM ThinkPad with a DVD player, the entire 7 disks of SUSE, bang, 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 leaving his NT partition intact, which is not something I recommend. And he didn't know anything. He looked at me and said, "Boy, that was easy." And I said, "Yeah, I know. That's easy." So obviously we want to teach more than just installing the operating system, but anybody tells you that installing the system is hard, that's bogus. That's completely not true. And the problem is that most people have never installed any OS, which is frankly not an unreasonable thing. Buy a computer, buy the OS with it, so you don't have to install it. Even I don't like to install systems. When I buy them, I prefer to buy them pre-installed. Now, we've had some people take some of these classes. Joe, you took the Pro class, right?
That's right. That's how I got involved with NYLXS, as a matter of fact. Just so you know that if you do come to the class, you will, Ruben will try and recruit you.
Which is part of
the
reason why
it's empowerment, and it's getting more people involved and getting more people into this whole deal, which is free software.
Well, what was your impressions of the Linux One class, Marco?
The Linux One class? It's good. I mean, I think it's one of the only classes that actually definitely tries to go about the manual piece by piece, step by step that's going on when the system installs. And that allows you to debug any problems you might have with further installs. And, I mean, the whole point of these classes is more about empowerment than sort of a step-by-step tutorial on how to do something, because often you'll be faced with a problem that you might not know how to fix. But if you have the empowerment or you have enough keys, you'll be able to figure out how to fix it just the way somebody who knows Linux better or been using free software for a longer time can actually fix a hell of a lot of problems that they've never seen before just because they sort of know how to go about fixing it. And that's probably the most important thing that we push in these classes. I mean, it's the empowerment side. It's not entrapping you into some, you know, Adobe Photoshop 6.0. It's about getting you free to use the tools you want to use to be free about your computing.
What did you find to be the most interesting part of the class?
Certainly Install Fest at the end. I mean, the end of the class is all the students host an Install Fest where everyone who comes to the Install Fest gets their systems laid down by people who have just finish the class with us, and what's amazing is how much these students are able to get a high percentage of the machines coming in installed, and that's really great to see that not only are these, you know, people finish the class and getting into the system, but they're actually, you know, able to go to a to the install fest and take charge of it. All of us just sit around and let them do it until, you know, I mean...
Yeah, that's kind of nice.
There's a major problem.
That's kind of nice. Well, I do like...
I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when you feel we've done something. The
idea of sticking an install fest on the end of the Linux 1 class was to have a confidence test to build your confidence so that when you're moving into the Linux 2 class or the Unix 1 class, which is the follow-up class to that, that you are in a position of greater state of mind and more receptive moving forward, because it gives you a chance to actually take an accounting of everything that you've done and figure out where it is that you want to go to. I have, but from my perspective, though, I think the most interesting part of a class as teaching it was when they take out their computers and for the first time and they hold them in their hands and they're sitting there with a dead hulking machine, right, with no operating system at all and just disks in front of them. And you can see a transformation of the class at that particular point that's unlike any other class that I've ever seen, period, is there suddenly becomes ownership. You can see it on the faces of the students. They take the machine out, they got their disks, and all of a sudden they realize that they own it, right? They own the disks, they can install it once, twice, three times, they own the machines, and you can see them light up with a sense of possession. And that is exactly what free software is supposed to be all about. It's supposed to be about developing that cyber sense of empowerment. And if there is two parts of any type of educational, right? One is sort of a memorization and logic part of it, and another part of any form of education is an indoctrinational part of it, right? If you go through medical school, they make you go through 36-hour rounds, weekly rounds, right, without any sleep, just so you can get up and pound your chest when you get done with it and say, who are you? You don't practice medicine. I am the doctor, right? Well, there is an indoctrinational aspect to the Linux 1 class, which is very important, which is that you come out when you reach that point, and you can see the indoctrinational process start to take hold, where they feel, finally, that they have real possession of these systems, and that they have real ownership of these systems, and they feel energized and empowered by this process. And that's personally what I find as the most interesting part of the class.
What I love is around day 4 or 5, which are the last 2 days, there's always a point in the class where you've given them so many ideas that people are just sitting typing away at this, trying different things. And it's not like other technical classes I've taken where they're on the internet looking at car ads or something like that. I mean, these people are just navigating through all the exciting new stuff they've learned in the system, and you kind of can't keep the class moving forward because every single student is off in their keyboard,
right
in the computer, and going, and you're sitting there, are they listening to me or are they completely in their machine? And
on the fourth day of the class,
moment.
I continually lose control of the class. It never fails. I took this class four times I lost control of this class by the fourth day of the class, simply because
people are taking control of their own lives.
They're so busy with the goddamn computers that they don't have time to listen anymore. Right. They become a bunch of squawking geeks. Or not geeks. And this is really what should happen, and we're very happy that that happens. Of course, that's when, you know, the next step after that is learning not how much you've learned, but then to realize this is like getting over the first foothill on your way through a mountain chain, right? You get over the first foothill and you go, my God, I got over this big hill, and you look over your shoulder and then you see the continental divide and you go, but this is just the beginning. And when both those things happen simultaneously, that's when you know you've really succeeded in terms of things. And certainly, when I used to teach the Pro class over at the New School, this was one of the great things that used to happen all the time. Here at New School is Parsons School Design, all art students. By the third week of the Pro class, half of the people were bringing in their laptops, asking me how to install Linux on it, and or GNU Linux on it. And that was a good thing to see, you know.
And once you start working with it, it's very addicting because every time you move back to a different system,
you feel constrained.
You feel
constrained.
Your hands tied.
Right, completely. You feel when you're working. That's the funniest part of all. Who's ever heard of this one? You know, don't tell me about this free operating system political bullshit. After all, it's just a goddamn computer. And it's just a tool, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So handcuffs, right? So, but what's interesting about that is that argument is the best reason, really, to use free software, because
anybody who uses free software that goes back to proprietary software finds that same experience you were just talking about. You feel so constrained. I mean, I just can't stand the fact that I can't flip Windows, you know,
yeah,
like desktop.
That's the first thing.
That's the first thing. Is like, God, I got all this clutter in front of my face. How do I get that out of my face without closing it down, which is not what you want to necessarily do? And you just feel constrained through this little window, you know, when you're used to this much wider world. And that's before we discuss that usually that when if you have a software problem that you need to solve, especially in the case of my office where I'm on a, you know, a wide pipe DSL, if I have a problem, I just open my browser and I find the find my answer on the web. I'm not just talking about technical answers, but I need a piece of software. I get it. No discussion, nothing. There's no constraint. I don't feel constrained. I don't have to look for shareware, something or other.
You don't have to write a PO for it.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, that's the biggest thing, right? The productivity alone. You know, when you find a library, you find a piece of software, you just download it and use it. That's it. You don't have to go to your boss and say, I need a few hundred or a thousand bucks for this.
I used to have a boss when I was at NYU who was so frustrated because he was so used to buying things for everybody, right? But I would ask him nothing. And he was so frustrated, he used to shove things on me, you know, that either I wanted them or not. I'm buying you a new computer. I don't need a new computer. I'm buying you a new computer. It's going to be a Dell. What do you want?
Justify their budgets. You know?
He didn't want to justify his budget. He was just frustrated. He would reward his people as part of his method of keeping them by just part of this relationship of getting them new hardware. But I didn't want it. So finally he cornered me. I said, look, okay, if you get me a machine, I want one like this. And I spec'd it out for him. And it was one of the first Dell desktop Linux boxes, GNU Linux boxes that they had. Of course, they messed that up, and that's a whole other story for another radio show. But, you know, he brought that box, and then it wasn't good enough that he just brought the box, but then he had to buy me like a 25-inch monitor. Not 21 inches, 25 inches.
Oh, that's nice.
Right. And he used to stand there in the corner. I had it shoved up against the corner, and I was in this corner of this office that where when the door was open, which you had to leave it open all the time because it was always too hot in there, that everybody going to the library would see it, and they would all stop, and they go, what are you running there? Is that a Macintosh? No, go away. I'm working, you know? And it would generate, I mean, just the monitor itself would generate this whole, it's a billboard. It's upbreaking. It was nuts, but I used to work, I used to use WinMaker, so WinMaker actually is based on Next, so I guess it did look somewhat like a Mac. I have personally never used a Mac more than 10 minutes, so I couldn't tell you. I once wrote something on a Macintosh, tried to save it to a file, and it disappeared on the hard drive, never been seen from again, and I said, that's it, no Macs. But in any event, it was very frustrating, because as Billy said, you know, no POs, right? I would ask for nothing. One time the girl sitting next to me said, I would really like to have a scan card reader for the PC lab, blah, 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 blah. And I said, and she asked for it. She didn't get it. She asked for it again. She didn't get it. So the second time she didn't get it, I called up to the office and I spoke to the secretary. I said, can you give me a scan card reader? I want exactly this one. And the secretary said, okay, I'll ask David, but he doesn't have anything in his budget. I said, fine. I came within like 48 hours. Plus a TV video card or something that I didn't want, right? And she said, how did you do that? I said, when you were working here for 2 years and you never asked for anything, if you ask for something, you finally get it. But we used to say, you know, and it's also another interesting point, right? No PO. How much money is it saved? We're talking straight dollars and cents. You're saving, every time you don't have to write PO, you're saving a huge amount of money for the business, obviously.
So forget expense. About the cost of the software, but just the business expense of passing around a PO from your department secretary to purchasing to whoever, you know, and then
just tell him that we have the journal. Okay, anyway. Anyway, we're having an open house, right? When, on Thursday?
Thursday.
We're having an open...
At Asha, on Thursday... We are having an open house for anyone who's interested in the training programs.
Okay, and make this announcement well.
Huh? Make we're going to have a lot of members of the organization. We're going to have a lot of pamphlets.
Wait, hang on.
We're going to have...
Start.
Say it like a radio guy.
Say it like an announcement, right.
Announcement.
On Thursday.
This Thursday, which is June... I need a terminal here. So I'm not going to kill something.
I need a terminal here.
Cal.
Yeah, kill her. Kill ice her. On this coming Thursday, the 6th of June, we are having an open house in the new location we have rented for classes, which is called Asha, which is at 242 West 30th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues
on the island
in
of Manhattan.
Manhattan, in the fine city of New York.
At 6:30.
At 6:30, and we'll hang around until probably 8 or 9.
And hopefully
we'll go for drinks afterwards.
Yes, we'll definitely go for drinks. By the way, that's another great thing about our classes. We go for drinks pretty
good.
We do a lot of drinking after our classes, sometimes before our classes.
No. All the classes run 3 hours and are on weeknights. Often we'll go more than 3 hours, but are scheduled to run 3 hours on weeknights. And we have two new sessions are starting up in the following week, meaning we have classes starting up on the 12th and 13th, Wednesday and Thursday of June, 12th and 13th.
Now, the next thing I'd like to ask is...
That's the end of the announcement.
Okay. All right. So the bottom line is that Thursday the 6th at 242 West 30th Street between 6th and 7th Avenue, the Free Software Institute is having a open house where we will hopefully have some previous students and some present students and some professors and teachers and some good people from our organization to shake hands with and to talk about the offerings that we have for you. Now, if you're really unemployed or if you don't have a lot of budget to try to upgrade your skills, this is a fantastic way to do it. Our classes are heapingly expensive at $300 a class. And members who are members of our organization get also discounts on top of that. And really, if I was coming into this field or even working in this field, then I would be taking these classes without doubt. You know, in fact, one of the reasons why I created these classes is because they weren't around for me when I was doing stuff and basically had to chomp and everything by hand. And it's a tremendous opportunity, and it really is. It's usually an opportunity to become, to learn how to collaborate and to learn how to deal with free software and to network with people who are interested in helping you and to being partners in your computing lives, if not in your personal lives. And that's it. That's what I wanted to say about the Free Software Institute.
So we've been told that we should announce to new listeners who is talking and who we are. And we'll probably be signing out because we've been on for more than an hour now.
An hour is nothing, but anyway, go ahead.
But anyways, my name is Marco, and we have Ruben and Billy and Joe Gristera.
Joe Gristera. Big Joe Gristera.
Our PR committee chairman.
Okay. Now, the next thing I want to talk about is... What? Lester Young once said, if you can't say it in 32 bars, maybe you just shouldn't say it. Mm.
Is this a critique?
Okay. Hemingway said, ask for not who the bell tolls, but the toll clearly bells is clearly tolling for you. Anyway, and I think he actually stole that from somebody in a queer use of fair use, which is the next topic of
the
conversation.
For
the
Bell Tolls. No, but there's a poem before.
Yeah. Okay.
Browning, maybe.
Of course, the premise for free software is the ability to...
John Donne.
There you go, John Donne. Are you saying that you're John Donne?
Anyway. There's a 7-second delay. We got the John Donne.
Okay. That's right. The next thing I'd like to say is... or talk about is fair use. Now, there's one of the other things that happens is when people say it's just a tool, software or computers are just a tool, the other problem that they have with not getting is that, of course, when we discuss the use in business or in education or even in the home of free software, we're not discussing just strictly things about in terms of their technical aspects. In fact, we're not really interested in technical aspects. I mean, we're interested that the software should be technically sound. That we're interested in. But the real issue, of course, is political. And so when people say, I use free software because it's technically better, that's great. If that's true or if it's not true, that's great. But what's really important is that the software is social engineering better, and that it's engineered for people better because it's designed in order to enable people. The premise that's necessary to enable that to happen is, among other things, very much an issue of fair use of copyrighted materials, especially in patented materials, especially in the context of innovation. In order to be able to develop free software, you absolutely have to have the right to reverse engineer. You absolutely have to have the right to investigate, and you absolutely have to have the right to get into your system and to take full possession and ownership of the system. You have to be secure in your private property. And these are very much, that's pretty much the definition of fair use. Now, at this point, free software is being tremendously threatened in Congress. I'm telling you that there are bills on the Capitol floor right now that are undergoing consideration and being pushed, especially in the Senate Commerce Committee, all right, which would end free software tomorrow, which would make all this redundant. Not redundant.
I don't think the Senate works that fast. We're not,
right?
There's a one-year consideration period even in the Hollings bill. It's better if it's not passing at all, but there's a one-year project proposal.
They could pass it tomorrow if they so choose to. They basically the DMCA overnight almost.
No, I read the Hollings bill, and there's like a one-year, like, they come back with the plan.
Yeah, that's what happened with the DMCA. There was a one-year plan where they were supposed to come back and
but that Hollings bill just broke. I mean, they got a Business Week heavily that's mainstream media.
Before we jump into the Hollings bill, let's first look at the bills that we're looking at. Well, first of all, before we look at the bills that we're looking at, the truth of the matter is I don't care about the bills that we're in some respects, and I'll tell you why. But some of the bills that we're looking at is, first of all, is this Hollings bill, which has come under different alphabet cities recently. One is sort of CSSS.
Yeah, this is really horrible and insidious.
If you look up cable television on Thomas, and you'll find all the whole history of all the different names of the
bills. The bottom line is that this bill is proposing that every computer in the United States should have a chip in it that reviews everything that's on the hard drive.
It's every digital device. Yeah, so it's more far-reaching than just your...
Let's just ignore that issue for a minute, all right? Let's just worry about the digital devices, the most general digital device, which is a standard computer, or whatever that means, all right? The bottom line is that each one of these devices is supposed to have a chip in them. All right, which will go over and go through your hard drive looking for illegal music or movies and then removing them from your drive without your permission. That's what they're asking for power to do. Another thing that's happening is that Hollywood has gotten together and they've decided that all chips or all chips that are designed to take analog or high-definition television inputs, streams, should also have similar technology in it.
Which would include your monitor card, your video card,
right,
and your monitor.
Now, the second one would not end free software immediately, but it would just basically make it useless as a means of communication, which is just about the same thing. The first one, which is the bill to actually scour your hard drive through the secret interface, this completely destroys the premise for free software, because that means that the hard drives themselves, you are not allowed to hack in order to be able to create file systems or anything else to talk to those hard drives unless you go through the chip. Now, what that means is that...
Well, it's basically actually taking away ownership
of your hard drive.
Of the actual physical computer.
Yeah, I mean, it's really outrageous.
It's
outrageous, but we'll get to the definitions in the first place. Now, the reason you might ask, now, why would I say that I don't want to really focus too much on these bills, right? And here's the reason why I don't think we should focus on these bills. If you go back over the last few years and you read all of the arguments that have been going on in Congress around copyrighted issues and fair use, with the ever-dwindling decrease in fair use, we are facing the same problem. We are constantly chasing our tails, all right? The motion picture industry of America
every 20 years they go and extend copyright.
It's not even that. Because the DMCA and stuff that's come up since then hasn't helped. What the problem is this, is that we've lost control of the conversation altogether.
Well, we're not a part of it. I mean,
well, we're not a part of the conversation, but we've also lost control of the conversation. Instead of reacting to every proposal, whether it's threatening or not threatening, and I don't doubt that they are threatening. In fact, I'm probably further believe that they're more threatening than most people would give me than give them credit for, because most people don't understand the concepts. But we have been constantly on the defensive end of this, and this is very much like the desktop problem chasing Microsoft. We can't continue working like this. First of all, we don't have the resources. That's number one. We can't keep throwing legislative energy at it, or court action at everything that we want to. That's number one. Secondly, there is this this misconception among certain segments of the free software movement that this problem will only be solved in the courts, which is complete gibberish. The courts are never going to solve this problem for us. The courts are not going to go over and say software code or software code is a form of speech and is protected by free speech, and therefore the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a violation of the law. In fact, everything has shown that they're completely never going to do this. And it's hard in my mind, although other people are probably up there raising their hands when I say this, to justify it also, because this source code is designed to do something physical. And in that case, in fact, it's the key thing that makes something physical. So I'm not convinced that we really that the judges are wrong on this in any event. The bottom line, at least not from that perspective, but the bottom line problem is that the courts are not going to side by us. Get it through your head, guys. They are not going. The courts are not going to help us. All right. Every indication is that the courts are going to screw us. All right.
Especially they're too slow.
This is the Supreme Court that interfered with state rights. All right. In order to go over and elect their choice of president. All right. This is a court that gave us the Dred Scott decision. Courts don't do what's right, and it takes a lot for a court to decide that they're going to overrule a will of Congress, all right, on something that Congress has been empowered to do, such as handle copyright. It just takes a lot. And the courts are not going to do it for you, all right? What we really need to do is we need to do two things. We need to refocus the argument, and we need to start to control the syntax and the words that are there. And by doing so, we will then arm the lawyers with new ammunition to be able to make new cases in courts, giving the courts fresh opportunities to reinterpret the current law and the new laws that we hope to pass in favor of our point of view. Now, how is this done? We need a fair use bill. Now, I know that there's a fair use bill of rights thing that's out there, which doesn't go anywhere near what we need to get done. We need a fair use bill, and if you go to www.nylxs.com, you will find on our website our proposed legislation that we're hoping to pass. The premise of the legislation, and it's got 6 or 7 points, I forget it off the top of my head already at this point. Don't bother. I'm not going to read it.
Huh? Well,
is that we want to make sure that there's an understanding that fair copyright is an exception to constitutional rights that otherwise that we have. Therefore, copyright is an exception to fair use. Currently, every lawyer will tell you that fair use is only a claim that you can make in court after you've been accused of violation of copyright. And one of the things that this law does, and probably the most critical thing this law does, is turn that around explicitly in the text of the law, which would say that you cannot find somebody guilty of a copyright violation unless it's proven that the use was not fair use.
Isn't that already the case?
No, it's not.
But that's what you just said, that you can use fair use as a defense.
You can use it as a defense.
Right. Well, you're saying that you should explicitly be allowed to use it as a defense.
No, we're not saying that we want to use it. We want to say that the accuser has to prove that's not fair use before they can find you guilty. In other words, right now,
the burden of proof should be on the accuser, not the defendant.
Ah. So, in other words, if you're making a copy of something, and even if I'm giving a copy from me to you, that they have to prove that's not fair use prior
Right.
To have any conviction.
Prove that it is fair use.
Well, that's much clearer now.
Okay? That's a major linchpin in it.
Sure.
Right? Now, under these circumstances, this strengthens the 1201 provision in the DMCA for the fair use provision, which is completely ignored.
Well, it has to be, since...
Because it doesn't make any sense. If you look at the 1201 clause for fair use, then the rest of the DMCA is completely worthless, right? So, that's fine. I'm willing to take the DMCA being completely worthless. But in addition to that, when the lawyers go in and they discuss now cases in court, they will be able to now say, Adobe, you have not yet proven that Dmitry Skarlov has not made fair use of this material in this violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, as you say that he is.
Well, you remove a lot of those scare tactics and the chilling effect.
That's right, and you get rid of the chilling effect, you get rid of the scare tactics.
The other point is that a lot of these things don't even make it to court.
That's right.
About the court not making the right decision.
A huge corporation can really scare an individual out of...
That's right.
Look at it from
its legal rights.
In fact, here it is. Just a couple weeks ago, right, in the edition, May 17th to 19th edition, the weekend edition of the New York Sun, right, which is the new 50-cent newspaper that's on the market. On the front page, which is a really large newspaper anyway.
In color.
It says, in color, music stops for these tots in what some say is a dispute on royalties. What's the issue here? In Park Slope, which happens to be Anthony Weiner's district, by the way, right, in the Barnes & Noble bookstore on 7th Avenue, right, the music industry insisted, because of copyright law, that they stop singing music to the children because of copyright problems, especially the song Happy Birthday. All right?
Who has the rights?
Now, this explains... Now, this is funny, except this has happened previously. This is not true.
It's not new.
Yeah. This is exactly the type of thing that immediately stops with fair use bill, because before they can accuse him of violating the copyright for the material, then they would have to go over and prove that the use, which is singing on a guitar in a bookstore to children in this case, is not their normal fair use. This is a powerful, powerful way that we have to go about things. This will arm our lawyers and give the EFF the opportunity to do the things that it's been trying to do. In addition to that, there are a number of other aspects of this law that are done. But we need, of course, is a lawyer to help us write this thing and present it. We have people on the Hill who are actually waiting for it, and yet we are delaying in actually writing it. Although I've been thinking in my frustration that I'll just write it on the back of a tissue, you know, and submit it in an envelope to Capitol Hill at this point.
Pasted letters.
Yeah. With a postcard. But it would be better if a lawyer actually wrote this in order to actually empower us. And the key here is that we want to say explicitly in legislation, in a statutory way, that copyright is an exception to fair use. The other thing that we want to do is we want to start controlling the conversation. Repeatedly, for example, and it's so infuriating, that people in Washington, especially some people that I won't name publicly at this point, who are supposed to be our friends, right, say things like, well, the stakeholders in this issue are not going to compromise on XYZ issue. And I'm like, who the hell are the stakeholders? My six-year-old kid, my five-year-old kid, these kids in Park Slope that were denied the ability to sing Happy Birthday, all right, in a public place, right, these are the stakeholders.
Be careful with the word public place. All I have to say about that.
Okay, but even a private business that allows the public is a public place.
Yeah, it is. It's not a public
place. Okay, we'll debate that later. We'll slip that into the fair use bill. Anyway, the
the mic's taking the cap. You're saturating on the cops there, River.
The language that is being used, we have to start reversing the language in the same way that I said, if you know the argument for the Microsoft desktop is going to be that they want to have corporate support, you have to come in with guns blazing and disarm that argument before they even get it out of their mouth. When we get in to discussions, and we obviously need to get more people in testimony, less people running around with plastic cards that nobody's paying attention to, right, and protests, place cards.
Placards.
That's it.
What we need to do is hit these arguments before they even start, right? So, like, the first thing out of your mouth should be the stakeholders in the copyright issue XYZ, that is the public and the small children in Park Slope who can't sing, all right, their songs, all right, feels that this is the case, all right, and disarm and take away that word stakeholders from the greed mongers. And then what you have to do is tag the corporations and businesses that want to remove your fair use rights and your property rights and your free speech rights, and tag them with a different phrase, all right, like monopolistic
fair use violators.
That's
what I've said all the time. You don't say copyright protection device, you say fair use violation device.
Fair use infringement.
Fair use infringement. There you go. And we can
like, don't ever say copyright protection device, just say fair use infringement device.
Maybe we should
device.
Just sit here for the next 10 minutes actually and come up with a bunch of phrases, and this would probably be the most productive use of radio time in the last...
ultimately a war of words, isn't it?
Well, we have to get rid of
don't ever say intellectual property.
Oh, intellectual property has got to completely go out the window. But... First, we have to really focus on stakeholders. That's one. And thieves. If you're making an access to the DVD,
when I think of stakeholders, I think of people holding wooden stakes.
That's because they're trying to drive away vampires.
Well, yeah, but they might just be trying to kill you.
Yeah, I think we're reaching here.
Well. Sorry, I thought we were brainstorming. I guess we're
That's
not.
Right, we can brainstorm.
You're like the Jack Candy version.
Jack Candy, my big thick novel, chapter 29. When I went to Congress, they told me that the state... So naturally, I fled.
You know, the next time...
Am I allowed to talk about Jack Handy's big, thick novel?
Is that fair use? No, I think what we should do is, next time we go down to Washington, we should just bring some steaks and go, we are the stakeholders.
We are the stakeholders.
Ribeye, T-bone, and...
Oh, wait, you meant that kind of steak? I'll get a vegetarian sausage.
Right. You can wear that. You can carry the wooden steak. In New York, you're not allowed to protest with a wooden stick, anyway.
But you can use a fleshen one.
Mm-hmm. Whatever that means. A fleshen one?
One made of flesh.
Okay.
Of animals.
The other term that we need to is the concept of who's the thief, right?
Sort of
like, when we go in and we testify, and if anybody's hearing this that has the opportunity to do this, which should be a lot of people, actually, in the future... Right. What we have to do is get up there they really already taught us how to do it. We just have to follow what they do. We got to go up there right away, and when they go over, let's say they want to get this Hollings bill through, right? We should be in there and saying, you know, we can't have this bill because it's as if then we're allowing the motion picture industry to come into my computer, steal my hard drive, and take it away.
And as a stakeholder, I can't let that happen.
And as a stakeholder, I can't let that happen. Yeah. That's it. Beautiful. And we got to say it over and over again, because that's what they're saying about us. They're saying is that if we don't let them come and steal our hard drives, which is what they're asking to do, then by all means, we're the thieves. I mean, this is a typical example of the thief calling the thief. I mean, which is very common. We got to be calling it like it is, which is they're the freaking thieves. What do they hold? They hold a government monopoly, all right, which is a government monopoly. It's a piece of paper, all right, that allows them certain rights and privileges. But it's my goddamn DVD, and it's my hard drive. Get your hands off the damn thing. When they go over and they prevent you from copying your DVD to your hard drive, it's as if they walked into your house and stole your computer and your DVD. And if they want to be really convinced about who actually owns the DVD, because they say they own the DVD and therefore they can control access, right? Then ask them flat out the simple questions, really. If somebody does come into my house and steal all my DVDs, do you file a police report or do I? Because if you file a police report, then it's true that you own the DVDs. But if I'm filing the police report, then clearly I own them. And what the hell are you talking about that I can't copy them to my hard drive? And let them answer that one. So we gotta get that bill started, and we have to start taking control of the language. And I think that if anybody else has anything to add at this particular point, that that might be a good thing to end the show on.
We're done.
Okay.
Cool.
Next week we'll hopefully have the ability for the listeners to call in.
Yes, next
and
week we'll
chime in
right
on the discussion, which must have been a little bit frustrating.
Yes, we know all about Wendy's cyber war. If Wendy doesn't write the fair use bill for us, she's not doing us a whole lot of help. Catch you on the flip side, and have a happy and healthy week. See you next Sunday night.